Any time the Sabbath comes up in the Gospels, we know that we are dealing with the heart of the conflict between Jesus and the religious authorities. And that conflict is never more clear than it is today. Jesus says the Sabbath was made for humankind and not humankind for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. And then, as if to underline his point, or in the views of the authorities perhaps add insult to injury, Jesus heals a man with a withered hand. In many ways, the Sabbath in Jesus' time had become exhibit A for how the interpretation of the law had become so picayune as to miss the point of the Sabbath in the first place. Walter Brueggemann, known to many of you, is a popular preacher and Old Testament scholar, and he's written a book which is one of many modern attempts to recover the spiritual meaning of Sabbath for Christians as well as for Jews and others today. And his is called Sabbath as Resistance, Saying No to the Culture of Now, and published in 2014. It is classic Brueggemann. Listen. In our own contemporary context of the rat race of anxiety, the celebration of Sabbath is both resistance and alternative. It is resistance because it is a visible insistence that our lives are not defined by the production and consumption of commodity goods. Or again, but Sabbath is not only resistance, it is alternative. It is an alternative to the demanding, chattering, pervasive presence of advertising and its great liturgical claim of professional sports that devour all of our rest time. One more. Sabbath is not simply the pause that refreshes. It is the pause that transforms. Whereas Israelites are always tempted to acquisitiveness, Sabbath is an invitation to receptivity and acknowledgement that what is needed is given and need not be seized. There's no doubt that we could all benefit deeply and spiritually from a renewal of intentional Sabbath practice, however and whenever we choose to observe that practice of entering into a different kind of space from the everydayness of our lives, a space in which there is not room for our workaholism or our rampant consumerism or the dominance of our various lusts that are so much a part of us that we fail to recognize them for what they are most of the time. Doing good on the Sabbath and remembering the Sabbath was made for us and not the other way around is all to the good, and it's fine insofar as it goes. But I think there's more for us in this passage and others like it that talk of the conflict that Jesus finds himself in. How on earth could a miraculous healing be so offensive, that the Pharisees went out and immediately conspired with the Herodians against Jesus how to destroy him? Not how to manage him, not how to get him to be quiet, but how to destroy him. How can we get in touch with the depth of the offense that would lead people who saw themselves as not only good people, but as the arbiters of good, who want to destroy another human being? What is that about? They almost certainly did not know that they saw themselves as the arbiters of good. It was part of the air they breathed. It was their assumed right. It was their privilege, if you like. Jesus, in what he said and what he did and how he seemed to undermine them and their rightful place, was as offensive as the prophets of old who railed against religious observance that did not lead to an increase of justice. Remember Amos, the shepherd and dresser of sycamore trees. "I hate, I despise your festivals. I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. Even though you offer me burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. And the offerings of well-being of your fatted animals I will not look upon. Take away from me the noise of your songs. I will not listen to the melody of your harps. But let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream." No wonder they put the prophets to death. An apocryphal story has Amos being put to death by a priest. Now, I can imagine, as I'm sure you can, plenty of things that give profound offense to many in our society and get the righteous, and particularly the righteous religious, exorcised. We can easily think about any aspect of our culture wars of recent years, but I'm not going to go there because that would probably just perpetuate what happens in our brains and the sort of raising up of our tribal identities. But I think we can get at what it's like to be so offended that we think something really important is being messed with or destroyed or undermined. I keep wondering instead, what is it in the air that we breathe? What is it in our assumptions, our religious assumptions perhaps, about the way our world is and therefore the way the world ought to be? And the thing that keeps coming to my mind is our whole packet of assumptions about what we're doing here, about worship. I think we bring, most of us, a whole lot of unexamined assumptions to this weekly practice. You can get at it if you ask yourself, what is it you expect or hope for in worship? What do you expect to get out of it? Maybe even the question. What makes for a really good service? And my informed guess is that our answers would include something about hoping to have an experience of God, hoping to meet God or be met by God, hoping to be moved in some way, perhaps hoping to be challenged, but not, of course, in any way that we find offensive, hoping perhaps that this week we won't have to cross our fingers during the recital of the creed, or perhaps hoping that somehow this will finally make sense to us, what we're doing here. And it's that package of hopes and unexamined expectations that make us susceptible to church fights. Fights about what kind of music is appropriate, or whether we should use wafers or some other kind of unleavened bread, or how we can make the bulletin more accessible to newcomers and visitors and so on. And I hear Jesus saying, you need to remember in the middle of all these things that worship was made for you and not you for worship. Or you could say worship was made for you and not somehow because it's pleasing to God. Worship, like the Sabbath, is more of a transformative gift, more resistance and alternative to the ways in which the world wants to shape us as valuable when we can consume. And instead we say and remember for an hour each week, no, we're valuable because we are of infinite worth, made by love for love. It's nothing to do with our capacity to consume. Worship is a transformative gift, and it's not something that we can ever get entirely right, because God cannot be changed or manipulated or forced to show up and grant us an experience, because we're doing everything in the best possible way and we know that we're doing it right because so many people have some kind of an emotional experience. That is almost always manipulation by worship leaders. No, worship is for us to be turned, reoriented to what really matters for life, to what's really true about life, to what makes life abundant, really. And of course, that can bring and include affective responses. Of course, we can have feelings. I'm not against feelings. When I'm not leading worship, I often find myself moved to tears at the communion rail, and I count that a gift. But tears are not the point. Life is the point. What we do in here is not the point. What we do in our lives, how we live our lives, is the point. Telling and enacting the story of what really matters around the table, including the revelation of the mechanisms by which we do violence to one another, including seeing how the Pharisees and the Herodians collude and conspire to destroy Jesus out of anxieties or self-righteousness. I hear Jesus reminding us this whole business is not about our doing something good for God. It's not about propitiating an angry deity, but rather God doing something important, transformative for us in our lives, week by week, month by month, year by year, over time. God doing something for us. So if we come with an open heart, an open mind, we're not going to have a peak experience every time, perhaps never. But this is the practice of a lifetime. It's by definition not going to be immediately accessible in every respect to anyone who walks through the doors. It will not be obviously attractive to many people. What will be attractive is us, those of us who have lived the faith, those of us who seem to have something to offer, those of us who seem to manage to be non-anxious and even joyful, especially in the face of challenge. We seem to have something to offer, and that's attractive. And what we can offer, at the very least, is an invitation to others to join us on the way, to be part of the Jesus movement, as we say these days, to come and see, to have life, and to have it abundantly. So none of us enjoy being reminded that we have to get over ourselves, get on with doing justice and mercy and walking humbly with God. Worship is not going to be sexy most of the time, not a mountaintop experience, although those can happen as gifts of grace and can be experienced even in worship sometimes. Imagine that. No wonder we say that worship is a core practice of Sabbath. It is resistance and alternative. It is remembering what really matters, so that we live more fully and courageously and freely and imaginatively than we ever thought possible. Is it lawful to do good or harm on the Sabbath, to save life or to kill? The Sabbath was made for humankind, and not humankind for the Sabbath. In our customary time of silence, I invite you to use it how you will, of course, but perhaps ask that God open our eyes to things that we do not know, that we cannot see. Perhaps asking God to open our eyes to the assumptions we carry,